Is that what 75 pounds of gold is worth? Okay.
So
your peak pound is not the same as
all right. So I'll just start here since we started a recording, and I'll say welcome to Shabbat Bible study at Narkees, 18th of February. And I'm glad to arrive to people already reading the selection. That warms my heart. And we've just read through Exodus 25, all about the lampstand. See, working back, the tabernacle and the beginning of its, what do you call it, items, things inside of it. And now we're going to go to Isaiah 60, verse 17 through 61. In our connection to this Haftarah, it's 61, 6 and 9. So we'll just go ahead and read, 6 and 9. Okay. I'd read from the beginning of the chapter, but we can basically just read. We'll basically just read from chapter 60, verse 17 through 61, 9. And then also Haggai 2, 8. And before we continue reading, I'll just say a prayer. Lord, thank you so much for bringing us here today. Thank you for giving us Shabbat. Thank you for giving us your word. And I pray that you'd speak to us, little things, big things, things that we haven't seen before, especially in these passages that are so distant culturally from us. And I pray that you would just be with us. Your spirit will fill each one today and throughout the service. In Jesus' name, amen.
I can start in 60:17, okay?
Okay, wait, weren't we over here?
Finished right here.
Well, why don't we just keep going? The row is going, and then it'll make us way back around.
Back row, okay, also back row.
60:17.
Yeah.
Instead of bronze, I will bring gold. And instead of iron, I will bring silver. Instead of wood, bronze. Instead of stones, iron. I will make your overseers peace and your taskmasters righteousness. Violence shall no more be heard in your land, devastation or destruction within your borders. You shall call your walls salvation and your gates praise.
Let's see. Then we can go to the back. Oh, why don't we start over there? David, you can keep reading.
19,
yes.
The sun will no more be your light by day, nor will the brightness of the moon shine on you. For the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun will never set again, and your moon will wane no more. The Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of sorrow will end. 21?
Sure.
Turn.
Yeah, you can. Oh, you haven't got. Okay. Who has one?
Let me just read. Oh, okay. No.
Well, I can read a verse or two. All of your people will be godly. They will possess the land permanently. I will plant them like a shoot. They will be the product of my labor, through whom I reveal my splendor. The least of you will multiply into 1,000. The smallest of you will become a large nation. When the right time comes, I, the Lord, will quickly do this. And Justin, you can...
It's just verse 6 and verse 9, I think.
Verse 6 and verse 9 of Isaiah 61.
But you shall be called the priests of the Lord. They shall speak of you as the ministers of our God. You shall eat the wealth of the nations, and in their glory you shall boast. Their offspring shall be known among the nations, and their descendants in the midst of the peoples. All who see them shall acknowledge them, that they are an offspring the Lord has blessed.
All right. Okay. So we want to talk a little bit about the Exodus 25 text and understand what's going on there. And then we also want to talk about how that is linked to these other texts. I guess we should read Haggai 2:8. As well, just for a reference.
Yes.
Haggai And then how many verses? I guess to the end of...
Is it an F?
Well, I think, let's see.
It's just one verse, isn't it?
It is an F.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, in the chapter.
We're debating how long to read when it says and following.
Yeah, do the whole chapter.
The whole...
I mean, to the end.
Like verse 23?
Sure. Just to get context, yeah.
Okay. All right. So why don't we read Haggai 2:9?
8.
Sorry, 2:8. Yeah, that's an important link there. And continue on to the end of the chapter. So... Do you want to keep reading over there?
The silver is mine, the gold is mine, declares the Lord Almighty. The glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty. And in this place I will grant peace, declares the Lord Almighty.
On the 24th day of the 9th of the month, in the 2nd year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Haggai. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Ask the priest what the law says. If someone carries consecrated meat in the fold of the garment, and that fold touches some bread or stew, some wine, olive oil, or other food, does it become consecrated? The priest answered, no. And Haggai said, if a person defiles by contact with the dead body, touches one of these things, does it become defiled? Yes, the priest replied, it becomes defiled.
Then Haggai said, so it is with this people and this nation in my sight, declares the Lord. Whatever they do and wherever they offer them, whatever they offer them is defiled. Now, give careful thought to this from this day on. Consider how things were before one stone was laid on another in the Lord's temple. When anyone came to a heap of 20 measures, there were only 10. When anyone went to a wine vat to draw 50 measures, there were only 20. I struck all the work of your hands with blight, mildew, and hail. And you did not return to me, declares the Lord. From this day on, from this 24th day of the 9th month, give careful thought to the day when the temptation, when the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid. Give careful thought. Is there yet any seed left in the barn? Until now, the vine and the fig tree, the pomegranate and the olive tree have not borne fruit. From this day on, I will bless you.
We finished the chapter?
Yeah, go ahead. There's a few more verses.
The word of the Lord came to Haggai the second time on the 24th day of the month. Tell Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, that I will shake the heavens and the earth. I will overturn royal thrones and shatter the power of foreign kingdoms. I will overthrow chariots and their drivers, horses and their riders will fall, each by the sword of his brother.
The Lord All-Powerful says, on that day I will take you, Zerubbabel, son. Son of Shealtiel, my servant, says the Lord, and I will make you important like my signet ring, because I have chosen you, says the Lord All-Powerful.
Right.
Question, which 9th month are we talking? What time of year are we?
The 9th month?
Starting September?
No.
No, Nisan is the first month.
Starting April.
September is the 7th, roughly.
It's interesting, you have several ways of counting months in the Bible, but
so
the oldest one is Nisan is the first month.
It's like Christmas time.
Give or take.
In Babylon, they count the months of the year beginning in the fall. And so Rosh Hashanah today is the Feast of Trumpets, which is actually in the fall. But that was a way of counting that was later after the people went to exile. The earlier way of counting was... The first month is Passover. It's Nisan.
Biblically,
they're both in the Bible.
It's the 7th month.
Right. It's counted 7 and not first, but it's celebrated as the first of the year.
Well, Gary said,
after
Christmas Eve, huh?
after exile.
Leave Christmas out of it.
Well, I hope Jesus isn't pagan.
No, absolutely not. But he wasn't born in the middle of Kislev, in the mud.
Okay, so Exodus 25 is opening a description of the tabernacle, and that description carries on all the way through the end of the book. So from chapter 25 to 40. Except for what comes in the middle of all that description? Anyone remember?
Of Exodus 25?
No, in the whole description, there's from chapter 25 to chapter 40, it's all talking about how to make the tabernacle, and then it describes them actually making the tabernacle. But there's something, two stories, one big story in the middle.
The golden calf.
The golden calf, yeah. And then, and all that is involved. And so it's interesting, you have this contrast of making the tabernacle for God contrasted to what happens with the golden calf. And it's also interesting where they got all this gold from. You know, if they've already given so much to the temple, what do they have left over for that calf?
Well, they got it originally, didn't they, from Egypt, coming out of
Egypt.
Yeah,
we remember it was mentioned several times, coming out of Egypt.
So when they gave it on arrival, so to speak, they obviously didn't give it all, because there must have been a whole bunch left.
Yeah. And it does mention for the golden calf how they took out their earrings and their nose rings.
Which they'd also been given.
Well, presumably they might have given all their free gold to the temple, and now what's left, well, let's take off our earrings.
But when they came out of Egypt, the women did give, I mean, they did give them all their earrings and their...
Right, right.
Bang, shoot. So basically they gave what was in hand and then took off all their earrings and things. Must have been pretty impressed with my earrings. I wouldn't mind earrings like that.
Yeah. Very heavy, anyway. Yeah. If you could come up with a whole golden calf,
you end up like the some of the African tribes, you know, with these huge, great things.
So the section from chapter 25 to 40 is like a big unit, and several themes come up here in the beginning that come up again. So we have the mention that it's voluntary offerings; everyone gives out of their own free will. It's not forced on them. There's no rule that says everybody has to give this. People just come and give it. So some might give a lot, others may not. And that same thing is mentioned again if you look at Exodus 35:21. It's kind of like an inclusio that way.
Are we talking about verse 31?
How many people were there?
Is it 21 or 31?
600,000 men.
That's what it says.
Yeah, so then, how many, what?
Well, it depends how you understand the word elef also. Whether it's a literal thousand or a fighting group.
So what's your guess?
Lots of people.
A lot of people.
So if everybody has 6 ounces of gold, you're talking a lot.
It also depends how many wives you've got and how many earrings they have.
Oh, wait, though. Now, I haven't read it today, but I'm pretty sure that the men and the women were taking out their earrings. It wasn't just the women.
No, but right. I mean, you know, it ups the ante. If you
remember, by 50% if both people have earrings.
But also if you've got more than one wife.
Well, sure.
I mean, it's a good family contribution, isn't it?
So, in Exodus 35:21, everyone whose heart stirred him to action and everyone whose spirit was willing came and brought the offering for the Lord, for the work of the tent of meeting, for all its service, and for the holy garments. They came, men and women alike, all who had willing hearts. They brought brooches, earrings, rings, and ornaments, all kinds of gold jewelry, and everyone came who waved a wave offering of gold to the Lord. That's interesting, I never really hear about wave offerings of gold. But so there you have just what we were talking about. And this verse is mentioned after the story of the golden calf. So that's also interesting. If you want to put it back into real time, what did that mean?
You're talking about with chapter 25.
We start with chapter 25.
No, but chapter 25 starts off with
everyone
man who wants to
give voluntarily.
Yeah, and now you go to chapter 35, and this is kind of what the outcome of it.
It's the outcome. However, they put the golden calf in before that, in the middle of this section.
Right.
And so is this, does this part where it's mentioning here in chapter 35 of them giving voluntary offerings, is that coming before giving to the golden calf or again after? Because what happens to the gold from the golden calf?
It's smashed up.
Yeah.
Ground up and then?
They eat it.
They drink it. So they have some golden excrement.
Diarrhea.
The golden calf?
I was thinking of constipation.
It was pretty big. I mean, we're going to be looking at it in weeks from now, but let's see. Aaron said, break off the gold earrings. Made a molten calf. You know, it doesn't say how big. Doesn't say how big is in measurements.
Well, it's big enough for Moses to see what's going on as
but
he's coming down.
If you go to, like, the Israel Museum, you can find, like, in Hatzor and these places, they have these types of Baal cows, you know, things that are associated with them. They're not, like, huge. They're, I mean...
Well, but maybe like
yeah,
this?
Yeah, right. I mean,
that's still... That's a lot of gold.
Yeah, but you can also base it on where were they before? They were in Egypt.
Right.
What size are the things that they put in the tombs in Egypt? They're not life size.
Right.
So it doesn't have to be a life size calf.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
But our pictures.
Our pictures, yeah,
show
right.
Such a
yeah, artists are not necessarily biblical.
No, they're not. In many ways, they're not. And it is funny how much pictures we've seen growing up influences the way we interpret the Bible. So
I think, how big is the Aron here?
It is an Amma, 2.5 cubits by 1.5 cubit and a half.
So
a cubit's like this.
Yeah.
So 2.5, well, I can't, what would that be in meters?
Think generally speaking, when they're made, they come out pretty well, what I call biblical size. They're not exaggerated or under. I mean, I remember when years ago, Jan Willem made a Mishkan, and we carried it all the way up from wherever it was down in. Where was it? Down in.
You mean made the whole tent and everything?
No. They just made the Mishkan itself.
You mean
the
angels
not the Aron.
You mean
the Aron.
Okay.
with the angels on.
Yeah, no, it's not that big.
It's not that big.
And it's not that huge, but by with the poles, it does take a few people to carry the thing up. And we carried it all the way up from the other side of Abu Ghosh right up to Jerusalem. It was quite a business. Quite a trip.
It says in verse 20, seizing the calf they had made. So if he picks it up and sells.
Ah, Moses.
Yeah.
It had to be small enough for him to lift.
Yeah.
We've got a detective in the house. Good.
He was very angry.
He was very angry. He had a little extra adrenaline.
Yeah.
But yeah, you could. Gold is very heavy, we know. But you could probably handle something this size and not so much that size.
What verse were you on?
Yeah.
She was reading from verse 20, I guess, of chapter 32.
I kind of just think you just push it. Probably didn't like lift it up.
Okay, so back to chapter 25. When he lists all these things that people may bring towards this work for offering, he says in verse 8, let them make for me a what?
Mikdash.
Normally, this is the word we use for temple. But, you know, it's from the root of holy. It's a holy place.
Something holy.
But it's interesting because there's Mikdash. So that I may dwell among them. And that the word for dwelling there is the word that we have for the dwelling place, Mishkan, which is the more typical word for sanctuary.
And in verse 8, it's
Mikdash in verse
Mikdash.
8. Yeah. So there's this blending of those ideas. Vasuli Mikdash v'shachanti betocham. And it says, everything that I show you, the pattern of the Mishkan. And that point, in verse 9, it's back to Mishkan, not Mikdash. And all the pattern of all its equipment you'll do. So This is also a refrain that comes many times, that you do it exactly the way you've seen it on the mountain. Exactly the way you've seen it. And it's very interesting, because exactly the way it's prescribed to be done parallels other people's understanding of what a temple should be in the time. Like if you look in the ancient Near East, what's going on other places, how you build a temple, there are some standard things.
In Phoenicia.
Phoenicia, in Carthage, where else? They found things that line up with the measurements we have. And
are these pagan temples or not?
Yeah, yeah, pagan
temples.
And notice when he's making the Ark of the Covenant, right? This is the seat of God. What is he going to put on that cover? What does he say to put?
Kruvim.
Or you might have cherubim.
Fat cherubs.
Again, back to this artist. You have to separate yourself from Italian Renaissance artistry, because there you have chubby little babies. Kruv is
like
a creature that's recognized in the ancient Near East. And notice here in the text, they don't have to tell you what it is. They say, make kruvim, because everybody knows what it is. If they didn't, they would have to say, by the way, this is a creature that looks like this, this, and this. It's like we can say, make a calf or make a horse, and somebody knows what that is. So he says, make a kruv. Well, if someone just said, make a kruv to you, what would you make?
A cauliflower.
Yeah. Cabbage, yeah. Today it's the word for cabbage. But in Akkadian, it's the word karibu.
And in Swahili.
In Swahili, karibu means welcome, but that's not related.
But it's also the name of an animal.
Caribou. Well, that's a little different. So, we have these creatures. They're known in other countries.
Do we know what it does look like? I mean, is it like a horse with four legs, or what is it like?
It's kind of like a sphinx, almost.
Yeah, that's what the Greeks called it, sphinx.
Sphinx.
It's like part lion, part eagle,
part
man. Kind of looks like a dragon. It looks like a monster.
Yeah, it's a monster.
Wow.
There are some in
so
the...
it's a bit like a lizard more, like a dragon.
Serpent.
Yeah, but it's got some lion. It's big. The Ishtar Gate in Babylon has some kruvim.
Oh, right, I've seen that, yeah.
If you go to the museum,
yeah, Israel Museum
in London, they also have massive kruvim. They're known to be angelic creatures who guard entryways. They guard cities, they guard temples, that kind of thing.
And Eden, the Garden of Eden.
Right.
Yeah, in the Garden of Eden, there were two kruvim. That's right. And a flaming sword that spinned around.
And the other thing that's mentioned in the Bible is the seraphim.
Right.
Like in Ezekiel. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seraphim and kruvim, they're both angelic creatures.
But seraphim are more like snakes, I think.
Oh, really?
Satan, the devil, was the crop of Carol.
Yeah?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Go to Ezekiel 28.
Yeah.
He was a
a kruv that turned bad.
Yeah.
But the seraphim is more snake-like.
Yeah.
It's amazing the effect of what you call Renaissance art.
Yeah.
Or even just kids' Bibles.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, because you just don't think of them.
Ezekiel 28:14. It's talking about the king of Tyre, which is often connected to Satan, but it says you were the kuv anointed. Yeah, the anointed.
Oh, that's Isaiah 14, you mean?
No, Ezekiel 28:14. Isaiah 14 is another thing, yeah.
Right.
But that doesn't say kuv.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have these kuvim on this chest with wings up. They are winged creatures. And they're spreading their wings up, and they're somehow intertwined, and they're facing each other. And God is going to dwell right in the middle there. He's going to speak out from the ark.
Just bringing his reference to Ezekiel 28:14, just check it out real quick. It kind of might apply to what you're
saying. So is this guardian cherub here? What's the word in Hebrew for
Isaiah? Wait, is you saying Ezekiel?
Ezekiel 28:14.
Is what does it
mean? Was he one of the two on top of?
Oh, right. Maybe.
Mercy seat.
Right, right. That's kind of what you were just talking about.
Vet kuv mimshach hasuchech.
It's at, no? At kuv.
So this at, slicha. At kuv mimshach hasuchech. So you are the anointed guardian.
Guardian cherub, that's what I've got.
Almost like covering.
Who is covering. Yeah, it's using the same word sochech that's used here in our text of Exodus 25.
Exactly.
And I have placed you in the holy mountain of God.
On top of the mercy seat, keep reading.
Tamim.
Well,
you were blameless in your behavior from the day you were created until sin was discovered in you.
But yeah, that.
What verse is that?
Ezekiel 28:14.
How do you spell kruv in Hebrew?
Kaf resh vav bet. Vav. Vav. Bet. Uh huh.
Yeah. So yeah, it is kind of like that same image.
A fallen kruv off the ark. Something funny to think about. So it's interesting that the pattern that God shows on the mountain, you know, that people are supposed to be so diligent.
You say it's not connected with the Isaiah, the fall of Lucifer, who's an angel of light, and so on and so on.
The images, yes.
But the image is the same.
Yeah.
Because here you have...
Sure. No, it is connected in that way.
Yeah.
But the word kruv isn't in Isaiah.
No, I'm not
14.
Talking
yeah.
about the word kruv. I'm just talking about the principle, which is the angel of light falls. He basically rebels against God, wants to make himself better than God or equal
right.
with God,
right.
and he's put out. And here you have exactly the same, an anointed cherub, an
right.
anointed kruv, whatever
falls.
He looked like, and sin has found him. I've got wickedness. And then he falls, and I drive you out in disgrace.
Sure.
I mean, it's an amazing parallel.
Right.
So even angels are not, or what? No, he's not really an angel, is he?
A kuv is an angelic being. It's just not usually the way we think
about
it.
I mean, because angel, like we talked about this last week, right?
Right.
Angel is the word for
messenger,
which is malach.
Right.
And we kind of created this idea of what an angel is.
Right.
Right. But it's basically...
a messenger.
Right, like in
it
Job,
can be many forms.
When Job talks about who comes in to see God, what are they described as?
God.
They're not called angels, right?
Oh, I think he's called Satan there, isn't he?
Well, I'm talking about the group that he's
right.
with.
Oh, right. They're called the Elim, Adat Elim.
Yeah, exactly.
The gods,
the
council
yeah.
of the gods.
Yeah.
So, in other words, the Kruv and this... Rifin, they're like this group of
creatures just like,
that
just
are
like Earth has many creatures. We have humans, cows, lizards. Heaven has many heavenly creatures.
Yeah, these are not the actual creatures. These are images of the creatures.
Sure.
They're not. They're like graven images.
But there's a principle.
Yeah, but we're talking about a graven image in the temple for the
God
temple of God.
Well, I think the word angelic is kind of artificial, because it really means messenger, but
yeah.
but a kruv...
Maybe this is where we got the idea for angels having wings.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
It is.
Yeah.
Sometimes they do.
Sometimes
angelic.
They do. You know, where they cover their eyes.
Or just
cover their
have wings.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but it's a kruv. I mean,
it's
a serifim there.
I think,
yeah.
I think I would call it angelic. But I don't know quite what your difference is between angelic and supernatural. I think there are different, even today, people who see angels see them in different forms.
Yeah.
Sometimes they look like just people.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they appear with wings or big light or something that is supernatural. So,
but there's
like
a prince.
I haven't seen one myself, so I can't really tell you more than that.
But I know a lot of people who have, and
sure.
I like the stories.
Sure.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Can I ask you another question? Did the Did the Renaissance and the Italian people, Middle Ages, did they have a right to reinterpret this in the light of their own culture? My question is this cultural or does this go beyond culture? Is this specific to Hebrew, to the Jews? Or, and are we to, you know, you're saying, where do we get our ideas of angels and we reinterpret that? Are we right to do that?
But when angels are more than just the Christian Judaic references, other religions that also have winged beings.
Yeah.
I think heavenly beings are created before God created the universe.
So did good. He, yeah.
Because
my question is,
Revelation 12.
Well, then his question would be, how did people in the ancient Near East know what a kuv is?
So,
where did they see them? How did they know?
You're saying that's what he's kind of saying.
That's kind of what he's saying.
Right.
And did God make American angels? Or Italian angels? Or, I mean, he talks about Hebrew angels here.
And it's not just Hebrew angels, though, because in Abraham's world, they had kuvim.
And culturally.
Before,
oh, culture.
Before Moses.
Culture.
Yeah. So it's greater, it's culture greater than the Bible. It's a good question.
You said that, you know, this parallels the pagan times, their own culture. So
yeah, concepts of how to build a temple.
It would be that, wouldn't it be that, God is trying to help the Israelites relate to the other cultures?
No.
No?
Yes and no. Look, we are all humans. We're all humans, and we all live in a culture. And when God has to talk to humans in their culture, he has to use things they understand, or it wouldn't make sense. Like, if he comes and gives them directions to build a jet plane, it's not going to happen. It's not going to work. So, of course, he's going to use the cultures they have. And it's actually a powerful, like you say, the idea is mind-boggling that
this even goes into like Bible translation.
Yeah, definitely.
That as they go into different cultures in the world to try to translate the Bible, the first thing they have to do is figure out how can they communicate a certain idea if those words aren't there or that concept isn't there. Like, is it if there's no snow in a culture,
snow is the word I thought of,
and you know you have snow in the Bible a few times, then sometimes the translators
like white as snow doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense.
So they have to
make up
say
a different.
Else.
They have to use a different idiom from that culture, so they get rid of snow. In other words,
when I was living in Uganda, on the east, which hasn't seen snow in 1,000 years, the kids used to come around and. Staff used to come around. I had a fridge, an old-fashioned gas fridge, and I could make ice. And very occasionally, there were sort of bits of snowy whatever, and
the
kids
frost.
Would come around to have a
yeah.
look. And say, well, you know, what is it? Well, how can that come down from the sky, sort of thing, you know? But it's a little bit like translating. Even, you know, we talk about in English culture, you talk about it raining cats and dogs.
Yeah.
You hardly put that into Chinese.
No, there's
whatever.
All ways you have to translate idioms. The bigger issue is when it comes to something that is given from the mountain of God as this divine pattern.
Right.
And yet even there you see cultural elements that can scare people. But I would say that's beautiful. That's how God has to communicate with people. And that's how he chooses to do it. So does that mean if let's say the Bible hadn't been given, and it was given right now. There was someone in our generation who was the Moses figure. Would the tabernacle look the same?
No, but the temple.
It'd be a smartphone.
Yes. Well, an incident took place somewhere in heaven. A war.
A war?
A war started in heaven. Michael and his angels fought. And this Satan... He seduces one-third of the angels.
Right.
At that time, there were no people to tempt. Satan worked with people.
So
after that, you know,
yeah.
creation took place, and then Satan came to Eve.
Okay.
Through a snake.
And sin took place first time in the Garden of Eden.
Right.
So the Garden of Eden happened now. Would Eve be tempted with a cell phone?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, that's where it's going.
What I was thinking when I was looking at the Ezekiel thing was the fact that these anointed guardian cherubs are anointed and they're guardians and they're there protecting, and yet they sin. And you were talking about the fact that the same principle follows, and it can be exactly the same amongst men. We can be anointed leaders or whatever it happens to be, and then when we sin and we rebel against God, then we're put out. Your heart becomes proud on account of your beauty and corrupted, and you corrupted your wisdom. I mean, that's pretty powerful, and it's just as powerful for us humans as it is for the cherubs who had a hard time.
Well,
we have forgiveness.
You know, God's temple is in heaven, because the dwelling place of God is in heaven, and he showed Moses the pattern, you know, the original.
Okay. So you're arguing that so this is basically just eternal.
What he saw in heaven.
I mean, it's what the writer of Hebrews says. He says that there's this pattern that the Mishkan was built on, which is what it says there. It says Tavnit.
And that's what does he scroll say too, that the earthly pattern reflects the heavenly one.
And some of us believe that the earthly pattern will again be repeated and the temple will be rebuilt.
No.
You didn't, but I
I tell you one thing. Go to Revelation 18 something. And heaven was opened, and his temple, the Ark of the Covenant was seen in his temple in heaven.
I just want to say
after
something,
the
though.
Destruction of the temple, all the temples.
This motif of heavenly temple comes back a lot, all the way in Revelation, even though there's some serious changes there. I wanted to point out, though, that as part of the instruction here in chapter 25, we get twice the mention that be sure to make this exactly according to the pattern you're shown on the mountain.
Right.
We have it in verse 9, we have it in verse 40. So it's being emphasized around all this stuff.
But
even
when,
though...
When God rejected his people now,
He rejected you?
He rejected the children of Israel and gave the vineyard to the
Gentiles. He rejects anyone who sins, and he takes them back, and because of his grace, he takes them back. There was no final rejection.
He rejected the grace.
And
God gave them.
You can find, in prophetic literature, you can find verses to both. You can find very harsh language. I'll divorce you. You know, you're not my people anymore. You know, 10 verses later, he's saying, you're my people.
Yeah.
How could I ever forsake you?
Yeah.
So there's no like this, see right there, that's final rejection. No. If you look at the whole picture, you mostly find grace. Even though I could have done that and I spoke harshly, I'll take you back anyway. Not because of you, but because of who I am.
800 years and 490 years, which ended in AD 34 when they stoned
Stephen. If you don't have grace...
That was the end of God dealing with his people. So
No. If you don't have grace for God's people in the Hebrew Bible, then there is no grace for us. Our grace, we understand grace because we can see it at work in the Bible. And God is not schizophrenic. He was the same yesterday, today, and forever. If there's no grace in the Hebrew Bible, there's no grace for us. That's it. We're all doomed.
There
was grace then, there is grace now, and there will be grace.
No.
That's the foundation that the Bible is given.
Have you ever heard of statute of limitations?
Not with God.
That's
not,
not the Bible.
That's not eternal.
And in fact, in the golden calf story, the very center of that is the character of God. And the very first thing we hear about God's character is?
Compassion
and gracious. Full of mercy. That's his character. And if you read his laws and you don't get that character, then you need to reread the laws until you do get it.
You know,
and sometimes it helps to study the surrounding culture, because that's what helps you see the grace more when you compare to alternatives.
Where it is.
There will come a time when the door of probation will be closed.
Oh, yeah.
Was closed for
Jewish praise people. The Lord, it's not happening in our time. I remember it.
I mean,
Sharon, let me say something.
Not individuals. We still have
okay.
Individual Jews.
So we need to move on a little bit.
This is cultural.
I'd also like to look.
It's
that this is
today's parasha downstairs includes the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And Sharon, you preached once on Exodus 22, and I wrote next to it God's calling card. And
yeah.
I'm sure it was you. And I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And it's something that the Lord repeats time and again in terms of his compassion, his mercy,
yeah.
his love, his consistency, all the things. This is what God has done. This is what God has done. And again, we get it in the story of Jethro downstairs in a few minutes, which is that the, you know, when Moses tells them all that God has done, the priest of Midian says, wow, this is the God I want to sacrifice to. There is no other God. And I think this is really what you're saying. And God's is totally consistent. There's nothing schizophrenic about him.
Yeah, his
level.
Character is totally consistent. Absolutely. Okay, there's one other thing. And it's kind of a big thing, but I just want to throw it out there quickly. And that is, where is this tabernacle going to be?
In the midst of the people.
In the midst of the people. So, according to Numbers 153, the Levites must camp around the tabernacle, that's the Mishkan of the testimony, so that the Lord's anger will not fall on the Israelite community. It's like this circle of holiness. The Levites are responsible for the care of the tabernacle of the testimony. All right, so that's in the center of the camp. And you also have Numbers 9:15. Well, that's on the day that the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, and from evening until morning, there was a fiery appearance over the tabernacle. So once this Mishkan is made, the cloud and fire, that pillar that's been guiding them, seems like now it becomes like a covering and descends on.
But that's not in this chapter.
The Mishkan. It's not on this chapter. It's going to come later on in our description. But the reason I mentioned the Numbers 9:15 verse is it has Mishkan right next to Ohel Moed. And in our chapters, in this description, those two words are combined. And why does it matter?
The tent of meeting and the tabernacle.
Yeah. So you have tent of meeting.
Numbers what again?
9:15.
And also throughout... these are two words. Sometimes they refer to the same thing. And as we get in this description of, we had the lampstand today, the table of fellowship, and of course the ark that is going to hold God's covenant binding commandments, and then also he himself, his presence, is going to emanate from the ark.
Doesn't Joshua spend a lot of time in the tent of meeting?
Well, here's the thing. Okay, so in our selection today, these two things are referring to the same tent. It's called Mishkan, the tabernacle, it's what we call Mishkan. Ohel Moed is the tent of, meeting.
But I don't see Ohel Moed here in Exodus 25.
In the whole chapter?
I mean, do you have it?
Let me see. Further on in Exodus, yeah.
Okay.
I thought the word moed has another meaning. Is it the same word with another meaning? Like moed,
it has moed means a time.
Like visit.
It's time.
It's a meeting. It's a time. It's something that you have set aside. So
appointment.
Yeah.
You know,
a date.
Like those
the
end times books. Time of appointments.
It's the time of the time of rejoicing.
It can be a holiday.
Yeah. It's in Genesis chapter 1, I think.
Moed.
Yeah.
A meeting. I'll just say a date.
When it talks about the sun and the moon.
It can either be a time or a place that you have set down to meet somebody. Or in this case, you know, a festival, because you hold it on a certain day and everybody knows. So there are these two words, that refer to where God's going to dwell. Sometimes they're the same, and sometimes they're different. We read from Numbers how this Mishkan, and then later Mishkan with Ohel Moed, is going to be in the center. And as we keep reading through Exodus, we're going to see Mishkan sometimes with Ohel Moed, and sometimes alone.
Hey, I was just thinking,
this
is extraordinary, because God puts it in the middle of the people. He says, this is the place where I'm going to dwell. This is where I want to meet with you.
Right.
And it's like you've also, the other way, you've got an appointment to meet with me.
Right.
Like the dentist.
And then, I want to add one more complexity to this, though.
I was thinking more spiritually about the way we should have appointments to meet with the Lord. Anyway.
So 2 Samuel 7, 6.
Our teeth are important.
If I could read. I have not lived in a house from the time I brought the Israelites up from Egypt to the present day. Instead, I was traveling with them and living in a tent.
2 Samuel 7.
2 Samuel 7, verse 6. So he said, I haven't been living in a bayit since I left Egypt and until this day. I walked around in a tent and in the tabernacle. In Hebrew it says, Be'ohel uve mishkan. Interesting. He said, I lived in a tent and in a tabernacle. So is he being poetic? Is he saying the tent was a tabernacle? Or is he saying, I lived in the tabernacle and in the tent? And so I'm going to give you another verse that shows there's this two-tent option. In Exodus 33:7, we're going to read verse 7 to 11. Exodus 33:7-11. Moses took the tent. Okay, what tent are we talking about here? It just says ha-ohel, the tent. He took the tent and pitched it outside the camp, at a good distance from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. Right? So he called it ohel moed. Anyone seeking the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting that was outside the camp. So here we have a tent not in the middle of the camp, on the way outside of the camp. So if this is one tent, there's another. So this one is called Mishkan, and sometimes Ohel Moed, and this one is called Ohel Moed. Okay. And when Moses went out to the tent, all the people would get up and stand at the entrance to their tents and watch Moses until he entered the tent. And whenever Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent. And the Lord would speak with Moses. When all the people would see the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people, each one at the entrance of his own tent, would rise and worship. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face the way a person speaks to a friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, son of Nun, a young man, did not leave the tent. Okay, so Joshua stays out in that tent all the time. Interesting. So how does this relate to what we're reading about with the Mishkan and all its, you know, its lampstand and the priest? The priest system, right, is this. You got the priest serving, and they live around here. And if you read Numbers, you have all the tribes in perfect order that I'm not drawing here, all around. The priests are like this buffer of holiness. You have an outer, you know, outer precinct, holy place and holy of holies, the ark. But here we have a description of Moses going out. There's some kind of tent. We don't know how big it is. And the pillar will stand there and talk to Moses. And Joshua's always in this tent. And what does it say in verse 7? Why would people go to this tent?
To meet with the Lord. Everyone who sought the Lord.
Anyone who sought the Lord. So,
I thought they all had their own tents. They all had their own
tents. Oh, everybody has their own tents.
They stay in front of their own tents.
They all have their own tents.
Right.
But this is a special tent that Moses put up for seeking the Lord, and it's different.
Because everyone can go to that tent,
like
and the other
one
they can't.
Have. Anyone could have.
Well, not just anyone, but any purity level. If you remember, if you're impure, ceremonially impure, you have to go outside the camp.
Right.
And this tent is set outside, way outside the camp. So it would be in the impure zone. So it's a very interesting concept because this one is like the holiest according to the priestly tradition. You know, you have to be ceremonially pure. And that's when you go this one and you have, you know, sacrifices. You have all these symbolic things that communicate who God is to the people. And then this one, in any state you are, you go to seeking God. And so, and God's presence shows up in both. And that's kind of wild as well.
Where's the verse, I think, in Hebrews about being outside the...
So, to me, it's kind of like...
Where's that?
This is your liturgical expression of who God is. There's very meaningful ceremonies, certain things you have to do in a certain way. You have to dress a certain way. You have to wash and do all these things. So in our world, because we don't have temples, that's like liturgy or very set ways of things. This is your more charismatic experience. So
personal experience.
Well, they can all be personal.
Maybe an angel came.
Personal with the Lord.
But it's less like we don't have any description. Moses put up this tent. It sounds like he just threw it up. It's not this big thing that everyone had to work on. It's not like a cathedral. This is more like a cathedral. This is more like
a tent.
A tent meeting.
It's a tent.
Like the Pentecostal tent meeting.
But
and
it did have an effect upon the people because it says when they saw that cloud on there, and they all went and stood in there.
Right,
and
bowed down.
It says they worshiped.
But also in our selection from Exodus 25 and on, the cloud is also on the tabernacle. So it's interesting. Like, when it shows up there, does it actually move from there to there? Or is it just part of it, or a new cloud?
Or split?
Well, God's conflicted. No, because he says, I don't want a temple. You know, I like being in a tent. But then there's other parts of the prophets where they said, how can you not build a really nice house for God? You know, God
right.
wants this. And so it seems like God can be in both places. The tent or the temple.
But I mean, the clue surely is the combination of what Anne says about the people worshipping. This is not just a place to go and have a good time, whatever.
Of course not.
It's for worship.
It's definitely
so
for worship.
I'm not sure that it's so conflicted.
Well, it's not that.
I still think the temple will.
There are two forms of worshipping God here. One is more the charismatic free form. And once more, you do it this way. And there are different emphases, and yet God's spirit is in both.
When I said conflicted, if you read the Bible, at times God says, I don't want this. But then other times he says, I do want this.
Yeah, it's like about everything, about fasting,
right.
about all sorts of things.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's
in New Testament theology, these are both united in Emmanuel. Because Emmanuel is with us, and that means that God dwells within us, and those two tents are united because we don't have to go outside the tent. God is within us, and we do not need Moses.
So
we have Jesus.
Well,
you are the temple.
You're both united, but if you remember, so you're right. The image of God being with us, dwelling in the center of us. That comes from this, from the temple or the Mishkan.
And Jesus said, destroy this temple.
This is open to anyone who seeks the Lord.
This is
open to anyone who seeks the Lord, not just Moses and Joshua. Anyone can go there if they want to hear from God. So I really think that this is a beautiful imagery, because not anyone can go here all the time, in whatever condition they're in. This kind of shows how this pattern shows how God is set apart. It emphasizes the holiness.
Purity.
The purity, and even that concept is hard for us to grapple with. because some people are impure having nothing to do with what they want.
You can be born a certain way
and not be allowed here. But everyone can come here in whatever state they're in, and God meets them in both places.
I have a point since we need to close here. A connection with Isaiah, the Haftarah.
Okay.
So what is the connection? I mean, what is Isaiah's connection?
Okay, so what is Isaiah's connection? Obviously, you know, the gold, silver, and bronze. Isaiah 60 spoken to Zion, which is Jerusalem. And it says you're going to be upgraded instead of bronze, iron, and wood. You're going to be gold, silver, bronze. And that connects to the beginning of our parasha, all these
expensive elements. And Jerusalem is where the temple is.
It is where the temple is.
The temple replaces the tabernacle.
Exactly. And we read the specific verse that talked about the temple. Build me a temple and I will dwell in it.
Right.
And that temple turns out to be a mobile temple.
So where's our New Testament connection of both these ideas?
You want to give us one? There are many.
Well, there's one. I think there's only one that ties both ideas together.
Okay, so read it for us.
Revelation.
Chapter 2?
21.
Oh, 21.
Revelation 21 is, if you look in verse 9, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven final plagues came and spoke to you, spoke to me saying, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. So he took me away in the spirit to a huge majestic mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem descending out of heaven from God. The city possesses the glory of God. Its brilliance is like a precious jewel. Then it starts to talk about the gates, right? The nations, the foundations. And you remember back in Isaiah 60, it's talking about what will your gates be called? Is it Shalom?
Yeah, and Tzedakah.
And Tzedakah, righteousness. And so you have this idea in Isaiah, too, of the temple in Jerusalem being described as well. If you go down in Revelation 21 to verse 22, after all of this description of jewels and gates, it says in verse 22, now I saw no temple in the city, because the Lord God, the All-Powerful, and the Lamb are its temple. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, because the glory of God lights it up, and its lamp is the Lamb of God. The nations will walk by its light, and so on.
Which ties back to the Isaiah passage.
Right, because what's it say in Isaiah?
That God will be the everlasting light.
There's no sun and there's no moon.
Yeah.
I think there's a missing bit, which is eight chapters of Ezekiel, which is talking about the building of the temple, which we haven't had yet. So it's, for me, it's just a process. I think we do come to this point when there's no temple. It's just the glory of the Lord gives the, God gives the light, and the Lamb is its light. But I think we're not. I think there's an interim bit.
But according to Revelation, there is no temple, and it's using the language that Isaiah is using about the temple and about Jerusalem to apply it to, I guess, Jesus, the Lamb, It's interesting.
And there, you could say the temple's been expanded to include all of Jerusalem in some ways.
Right.
The way Jerusalem is described is kind of like a temple for the whole world.
During the time of the temple, was there intensive meetings?
That's a good question. Because it doesn't seem to be. We have mention of the Mishkan, that it was in Shiloh. And we never really hear when that temple or when that Mishkan gets destroyed, but we can assume it's by the Philistines. There was a great battle in effect when they took the Ark. And then after that, they have this whole, you know, all the plagues in the Philistine town, so they send it back up, and it's put to Kiryat Yarim, which is not Shiloh, right? It's Abu Ghosh today. You can go there. So it was there for 20 years, but then we also have Solomon goes to Giv'on, by, you know, Pisgat Ze'ev area. He goes there and there's a Ohel Moed. So, I don't know, were they two tents? Which one had the ark? I mean, it says the one had the ark, did it move to the other before the temple? And then during the temple, it seems like they were combined. But maybe there was still a tent.
It's Givat Ze'ev, not Please God save.
Okay. Well, I'll just say Giv'on. Biblical Giv'on, wherever you place that to be.
Right,
so, but I think the concept is still open there. God is not limited to the temple. He uses the temple to speak in a powerful way, just like he spoke to Zechariah about John the Baptist. But it's really, what we have here, this is priest, right? This is prophet. God speaks both ways. And yet these systems are very different. And this one is more restrictive and this one is more free. And they, all through, you know, biblical history, both of these things are going on. Some prophets were also priests. Some, I guess that makes some priests also prophets. Some were not. And,
Wait. Okay. And I was going back to Exodus 25 where it says the Mishkan will be among...
In your midst.
In your midst.
Right.
And Isaiah 60:61 also has that idea, right? That God is the light. He's all that. And then Revelation says...
He's in your midst.
The residence of God is among human beings. He will live among them and they will be his people and God himself will be with them.
Yeah.
That's in Revelation 21:4. So... There is that kind of connection of, from that verse of Exodus 25, of is it
being in your midst is like a theme.
Have we got time? Just in a, I was late, but what's the, is the time to link it with Haggai? Because I was finding it very difficult to make the link with Haggai.
It's the gold.
Well, there's also, we'll just quickly mention Haggai. You also have the theme of the gold and the silver,
right?
And
that belongs to him.
And it's all related to the temple,
right?
Also, there is a theme of being a blessed seed of the Lord in both of these. They're connected by blessing. Because gold and silver is in all of them. The blessing I just found in here, I didn't see anything in chapter 25 that had that, but it was interesting that the other two had that connection. And I think we're running a little late today, so...
I was going to share just one thing in Haggai where it says, the glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty. And in this place I will grant peace, declares the Lord Almighty. And that's the text in Kfar Etzion, for those who've ever been there, in the Sound and Light show, when the whole of Kfar Etzion is destroyed three times and then rebuilt, destroyed by the in different wars all the way through. And then when it's rebuilt in 69... the text that they have as a closing text is that text. The glory of the present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty. And in this place I will grant peace, declares the Lord Almighty.
Yeah.
And this is a reference for that Jesus will walk in that temple.
Mm. And
when he said, my house, temple.
Briefly, that verse that Gemma just read, there's also a little play there because it'll be called the house of peace, shalom. The old name, we have Yerushalayim, and of course the old name for Jerusalem was Shalem.
Mm-hmm.
Shalem, Shalom, there's a place name.
Just think of Shlomo.
Shlomo.
It's his house. He's
so it's all kind of connected to Jerusalem, which of course this first Mishkan was
just
not.
Just a nice example of...
All right, so we've gone to a lot of different topics here, but... I hope you found some things you can think about.
Shabbat